Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today, we're continuing our What's Good segments, talking with someone who's been great in tons of stuff. Yes, Dear, My Name is Earl, Glee, Meet Dave, Welcome to the Family, Justified, Sully, and the new YouTube original, Wayne. But listeners to this podcast best know the guard to the gateway to Earth, the doorman, Mike O'Malley. Mike O'Malley, welcome. Everything is frog.
Mark, thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you guys. It's great to talk about The Good Place, which I was so proud to be a part of. I've been trying to work with Mike Scherer for a long time.
Is that true?
It is. I met Mike. He's a fellow Red Sox fan, mm-hmm. and I had met him through some mutual friends many years ago at a benefit for the Red Sox, Boston Red Sox, and he was touted. He was at that point, I think, working on Saturday Night Live and was touted as a really, really funny guy, which he is. And when he was doing Parks and Recreation and that was being cast, I was up for the role of,
Ron Swanson.
Ron Swanson. And it was between me and Nick Offerman, and I tested for it and I didn't get it.
Concerned that I would be picking a scab.
I drive by Nick's mansion every once in a while, and I just, you know, I look at what it would be like to live in a house with 25 rooms. But it's
Megan,
fine.
It's Megan's fine. Mansion.
Well, no, it's I saw the inside paperwork on that, and it's Megan's mansion too. But even if they got divorced, I don't want them to get divorced. But they would both have two pretty good mansions.
They'd be fine.
They'd be fine. But yeah, I really wanted to do that part, and broke my heart, and so I didn't forgive Mike for a long time. In fact, I really still haven't forgiven him.
I was fascinated to learn that because in Googling, I saw that you did one episode, which we'll talk about of Parks and Rec later, but in just putting together, like looking for video clips of it, I think I searched for Parks and Recreation, Mike O'Malley, and I came across, I think, a Vanity Fair interview or something with Mike mm-hmm. saying that you had tested for that role. I had no idea.
Well, I'm so glad that he talked about it in Vanity Fair. I mean, just like, why not, you know, again, just talking to as many people as he can about this role that I lost out on a series that went for a long, long time. And now, look, I have books that I want to write. I could have written, okay?
Sure.
I work in a wood shop too, okay? Listen, this, I would like to be out on a stand-up tour just, you know, like Nick Offerman.
Playing
you know what's
songs.
Funny? You know what's funny is
Playing
that Nick
song.
Offerman, when I first moved to Los Angeles, there was a theater that they had built out of this old building in what is now Koreatown. Hmm. And I went to go see this, it was a 90-seat theater, and I went to go see this play and this actor, and it was just unbelievable. And he was funny, and he was compelling. And this is 1998, 99. And I was just, just like, that guy's going to be a big star. And little did I know I'd be competing with him for the role of Ron Swanson and lose it. But it's fine. I'm doing fine. I mean, look, I got podcasts I'm doing now. And It's fine. I mean, I'm guesting on podcasts. I'm not hosting podcasts, but I'm guessing. I'll do a podcast every 2-3 years, you know, just tell people what I'm doing. And
do you have any interest in hosting a podcast? You seem like somebody that takes very easily to this.
Well, I mean, yes, I'm interested in talking to people like you're talking, and that you talk and you're interested in people. And I mean, I really am. It's just,
no, I'm done.
You know, here's the thing. I need to go make some money, right? I'm just trying to get, I got 3 kids, you know, I'm Irish Catholic. We had kids, you know?
Sure. It doesn't seem like you're starved for things going on, though.
I am not starved for things going on.
No, I mean, I'm looking just at your IMDb, like, obviously, you're known as an actor for a billion things, mm-hmm. but, like, you're a creator of stuff. You've written on Shameless. You're the creator, producer, and writer on...
Survivor's Remorse.
Survivor's Remorse. Sorry, yeah. my computer's slow.
No problem. You know, I had, you know, around the time that I lost the part to Nick. I went into a deep depression. I decided if I can't beat out these guys for roles.
Some handyman.
Well, no, I mean, listen, I don't have as much hair as Nick, and I can't grow as full of mustache. So I just knew that I had to do something different. No, I'm kidding. I'm trying to think, when did Parks and Rec start?
It started about 10 years ago, I think, didn't it?
So I did, I was on Yesteryear, and then I didn't want to go right to doing a comedy. And so I did a show with Christian Slater where I got to play a spy. It was called My Own Worst Enemy, and it was a great job because I got to play, you know, 2 different roles. That was on NBC also. That got canceled. And that's when I took a job on Shameless because I really wanted to have the experience of being a showrunner and running my own show. But at that point, you know, I was in my early 40s and I took a job on Shameless. I helped John Wells. I did some punch up.
Punch up is what?
Punch up means you just go in when they're getting ready to try to sell a script that you just add some jokes or add some perspective. Mm-hmm. And Shameless is based on a English show that had been about an Irish family for a long, long time. And I think they maybe wanted some Irish Catholic perspective in there. So they asked me to come on and I had a great time doing it. And then John offered me a job as a staff writer on that show. At the same time, I was doing Glee. I was playing...
You were acting on Glee.
I was acting on Glee. And so oftentimes my scenes would just be with Corey Monteith, who played Finn, or Chris Colfer, who played... my son, Kurt. And so it wasn't, you know, completely demanding. We'd have very intense days, 1 or 2 days. And so I had time. And so John, I was very lucky because, you know, John Wells let me go do that. And still, as long as I was getting my work done writing. So this is a long way around of saying is that I really wanted to get this, you know, fire hose of show running experience, wrote on this show for the first 4 years, really learned how to do the job. And then as a result of that, I ended up selling a pilot with, LeBron James, Maverick Carter, Tom Werner, to Stars, about a young basketball player from Boston who finally gets a big contract. And the show is really about what happens. When, you know, we've all seen these 30 for 30 documentaries about athletes or musicians who get all this money. They feel like they have to take care of everybody. And then suddenly the money's gone. And how right. do they start over? This is a show about what happens when we see at the intersection of a guy first getting that money, how does he not fall into that trap, even though he's someone who's a very thoughtful, caring person who wants to help people? On that, I was not an actor. I was just the showrunner. I created it. I ran the room. I ran the show. And that was awesome. Very immersive job.
That's a completely different skill set.
Yeah.
You've written 3 plays, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, yes.
So
it's the same thing. As it's like, I mean,
but you start on a blank page. You can
right,
do that.
Right. I mean, I think all actors should write because it's a way to, I believe, it's a way to not only understand the craft of what they have to do better, but it's, you know, it's drama. And I say to people who, you know, want to start writing, I say, can you win an argument? Mm. You know, if you can win an argument with anybody, your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, you're going for a raise, you can write drama because that's what it is. It's conflict.
Wow.
And so that's, you know, I mean, I don't mean to diminish it. I'm just saying, like, drama is not the same as, you know, writing a novel and being necessarily descriptive. You have to be observant. When I say drama, I mean comedy too, but, you know, people get in arguments all the time. And sure. I actually think that that's what, you know, good television is. It's like anytime you walk down the street and you see people chatting, you don't stop and listen. If you see people fighting, you stop and listen.
You were fighting with security when I walked in today.
Yeah. I was not fighting. I said, why didn't they? Well, now you're making me sound like a
asshole.
He was saying, this is where you're going. I said, you know what? They always forget the apostrophe in my name. Mm-hmm. And certainly, as we are now experiencing, because when I ran into you, he was taking me to another building.
He sure was.
And in fact, you stopped and said, we should not be going there.
Right. Yeah. I won the argument. I should write. As an actor, I should write.
Here's the thing. I played a guard on The Good Place, so I know what this guy's up against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was kind of a bit of a meta situation.
Yeah.
What role did you play on Parks and Rec?
I played a guy, Bill something. I own a van, a rental van company, and I think I was trying to screw them over. That was a trip. I mean, that episode was probably in the fourth or fifth season. I had great stuff with Nick. I hated working. I hated doing every moment of it. I kept thinking, wait a minute, I'm here on a day rate. I'm here on a day rate. This guy's making probably $275,000 today. And I'm seeing what he's doing. And I can do that. I can do what he's doing. What did they not see in me?
Should we get Mike on the phone?
It's fine. He's doing fine.
He's fine. We had an interesting experience. The first sneak that you were ever going to be part of The Good Place was shown at San Diego Comic-Con in 2018, last summer. You could feel that there were, I don't know, 2,400 people in this ballroom, and it was the little tease that they did of the very beginning of season three. Mm-hmm. Ted Danson walks down that bridge and comes upon you, and you're one of those actors that 2,400 people went, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah.
Like,
thanks.
Yeah, it's kind of great.
Well, I mean, I've been hanging around a lot, you know.
Hanging
I think
around.
That's part. No, I mean, but look, I was on a series for a long time in the early, you know, 2000s.
Yesterday.
It was on the air for a long time, and then it was on syndication. When you're on a show like that, even back then, there was not a lot of stations. So even if people didn't watch Yesterday, if they watched football, they saw promotions for Yesterday.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right? And I've played a character for many years on ESPN, this crazy Boston sports fan called The Rick, and then you go and you do something like Glee. And so it's very interesting to have a career where I can almost tell when somebody comes up to me, I know what they're, I can tell they're
going to. You can pinpoint which project?
Nickelodeon Guts, if it's Yes Dear, The Rick, Glee. If a biker dude comes up to me, it's Justified because they did an arc as a, you know, bad guy on Justified. And so,
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's fun.
How did the role of the doorman get presented to you? First question, had you watched The Good Place at all up until that point?
Yes, I had watched, I think, one episode.
Okay.
I think Mike has felt terribly, terribly bad for many years for not casting me as Ron Swanson, and that he made me go through at that point. You know, I was an accomplished actor with many offers and many things, and he said, come in and test for this part. And I was like, am I in the first? Because, I mean, I'll come do it if you really want. And I found out they had no desire. It was just a sort of stalking horse for Nick Offerman. But, I mean, I think that for many, many years, whenever I run into Mike Schur, he sort of just hangs his head and feels bad because I think at one point he saw my kid in some ripped jeans and he was like, this guy cannot even afford to fix his kid's pants. And my kid had some dirty Nikes on. It's like, oh my God, this guy can't afford new Nikes. He can't even afford the cleaner to clean the shampoo for the Nikes. But anyways, I run into Mike on occasion and he called me up. He said, you know, would you like to do this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike is just, I had a ball doing the episode of Parks and Rec and he's just so funny. And, you know, so listen, anytime you can be working with a showrunner of his capability, it's really, you're just hoping he writes you a bigger part.
For sure. Yeah. How did he pitch it? What did he say about?
I don't know, he said, do you want to do it? And I said, yes. I mean, that's basically, you know,
that's real,
kind
right?
of. Yeah, because again, you know, Mike, I really trust him. He has a reputation of being a phenomenal guy. when you have, you know, somebody of his stature and talent calls you up and says, do you want to do something? Unless it's, you know, unless you read the pages and like, this is really something that is incongruous with what I value.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
You've mentioned you have kids. How old are your kids?
16, 14, and 12.
Great. And how have you gone about imparting to them ethics and morality and what's up and what's down in the
universe? Well, I think that anyone who knows me knows you just, if you're just around me, you could just, it's just lead by example. Okay.
That's it's just us. It's just,
yeah, I mean, it's just, it's
moral
just,
osmosis.
Yeah, well, I just think it I exude morality and ethics. But I know it's an interesting question because I don't know how, you know, other than talking to them all the time mm-hmm. about stuff,
sure.
How, you know, things get imparted. It would actually be an interesting question, you know, to hear them answer.
I wonder, yeah. I wonder how they would reflect, what they would say as to how did you learn what's good, what's bad.
Well, you know, we have a sign that's on in at our front door before you walk out the door, and it says work hard and be nice to people. And the work hard is in bigger blocks than the be nice to people. And what I think is interesting about that is the be nice to people part is in a smaller pitch size. Because I think that that's got to be presumed. Like, mm-hmm. the be nice to people, that you should just know that. Like,
that's
that really you shouldn't be, have to be reminded that all the time. The work hard stuff, you got to be, all of us have to be reminded that because we're in competition for everything. Mm-hmm. We really are. But raising kids is awesome. I love it. I wanted to be a dad. I love being a dad. I say to my kids, the most important thing about being a dad is marrying the right person.
Hmm.
And that's the thing is, you know, my wife is an elementary school psychologist.
Oh, wow.
She's easily one of the loveliest people I've ever met and that anyone's ever met. And you never find anybody say a bad word about her. And she's extraordinary. And, you know, when you marry someone like that, that's very easy because she loves being a mom. She loves parenting. She loves caring about them. She's thoughtful and she's very smart about, you know, things that are happening with them as they've moved through their various stages that, you know, she has her, you know, master's in education. So, mm-hmm. you know,
she's yeah, come equipped.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny. We talked with Dr. Todd May from Clemson University about ethics in everyday life and also separating the art from the artist. Let's listen to this clip. Let's talk a little bit about ethics in everyday life. I know a lot of people are struggling with how to enjoy the music of an artist that is in the news because of, you know, sexual problems and legalities. And I'm thinking about people like Michael Jackson or, you know, the movies of Harvey Weinstein and Bryan Singer or the television of Bill Cosby.
There's a tendency to judge people on a single scale, a moral scale. And perhaps if they're bad enough, maybe that's the only scale that's relevant. But in general, a lot of creative artists are not morally upstanding people. My favorite author, William Faulkner, was a horrible human being.
Is that true?
Yeah. One of my professors had an office next to him at the University of Mississippi, and apparently Faulkner would take people into his office who were aspiring writers getting to see the great William Faulkner, and he'd just humiliate them, right? Oof. For the fun, and then go brag about it, right? He was...
Wow.
So I think that there are different normative scales on which we think about people. So there can be a scale of creativity in which we admire them, and a scale of morality in which we don't admire them at all. And we have to hold them together in the same person. And the wrong thing might be to say, let's find a single scale that will resolve all the conflicts. But right. I think we should see the normative complexity of people. Everybody's morally complicated, right? Nobody's morally in the clear, and nobody's morally just awful, right? And I think probably that's where most people fall. But with a person who's particularly creative, it maybe gets enhanced on both ends, right? The creativity and the immorality.
I just noticed in this moment, are you wearing a t-shirt that says an Emmy for Megan 2019?
I am.
That's wonderful. Mike O'Malley, have there been people that you've decided, oh, well, no more of this. I'm not going to watch these shows or listen to this music, given, you know, things in the Time's Up culture, the Me Too culture?
I was developing at the time that, you know, a lot of the stuff came out about Bill Cosby. I was writing a new sitcom for him.
Is that right?
Him. Yeah, for NBC.
Really?
And the last time I was in this building was to, you know, pitch that project.
What year would that have been, roughly?
I don't know what I'm sure somebody will do the fact checking, but whenever, I mean, it was 2015, I think.
Okay, fairly recent.
Yeah.
Yeah, before, like, before it really, Hannibal
you know,
Buress.
Before it broke, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, well, it was right around that time. The deal was already set before, you know, he went and he said those things,
yeah.
But exactly, he said those things, and because he said those things on stage, then the New York Times was able to say, hey, I'm just, we're not reporting that any of this stuff is true, we're just reporting that somebody said this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, then it all started to obviously snowball because now the New York Times is reporting on someone saying this, and then other people are saying, well, wait a second, you know, what the heck happened here?
Right.
And so, you know, if you were to meet him, and we met with him many times when I was writing the project, I mean, the guy's a legend.
Yeah.
He's hilarious.
I'm sure.
So, I mean, then you find out this stuff happens, you're just like, this is just, then you just start to unravel the, you know, the power and the influence of suppressing, you know, the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very sad, you know, very, very
horrifying.
Sad for all these, horrifying for
yeah.
all these women. It's just horrifying. And you just, it's like, you know, it's like psychopathic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty pretty unsettling to when you do unravel that and you find out the power dynamics and also, you know, use of drugs and things. Like it's
yeah. Well, I read this amazing graphic novel. I think actually they made a movie about it, about Jeffrey Dahmer, that was written by a kid who went to high school with him. And he was just like, yeah, this guy was just like a big, tall, kind of like goofy kind of guy who did stuff for attention. And it's just like, how did he turn into this?
Yeah.
My Friend Dahmer, it's called.
Oh, wow.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But again, you know, this guy's writing this book. He's just like, I grew up with this guy.
Yeah.
I knew this guy. I went to school with him every day.
Yeah.
Now he's this. He's eating people.
How does this happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people got to process that. They can't be like, you can't write about that.
Right. It's difficult, but I suppose it's, you know, healing to get to the bottom of it, to explore it, to not put it under a rug and forget about it.
Listen, man, if you can talk about it, you certainly should be able to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be like saying, you can't even talk about it. You can't even report this story in the newspaper.
Can you win an argument? I like it. Had you ever worked with Ted Danson before?
Never.
Really?
I loved him. God, what a great guy.
Isn't that
fun? That's a great guy.
Yeah.
That's like one of the singular great guys in show business.
Yeah.
If not life.
People always ask, and it seems like a bit. It seems like a, you know, a fairy tale, but like he's legitimately fun and kind and interesting. I did a set visit with some people a few weeks ago, and Ted was drilling down on their lives and what makes them tick and what makes them happy. And it's not an act. Like, that's who he is.
Yeah, he's just a nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can only imagine with all the money these guys are making how easy it is to be nice. Ted, Nick, Mike. And there's a
Hannibal
common
Buress.
Thread here. Jeffrey Dahmer.
Talk a little bit about what it was like. Your desk is at the end of, it's in the furthest outpost.
Well,
of...
I just, you know, I showed up and they got, you know, they had, Mike had a very specific idea about what I was going to wear for a uniform. It was a color that no one looks good in. You know,
that was mentioned?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, no. I think that.
It's sort of a gray, right? With a
light
piping.
Brown.
Light brown.
Light brown
okay.
with gold piping.
Yeah.
And, you know, 100% polyester.
It feels a little like a hotel doorman somehow.
A little like that. Yeah. The character, as written was called The Guard.
Yes.
I think it's been changed to The Doorman.
Yes.
But it was The Guard. Which is what's so fascinating about it is because I had a tag that said guard and then it was changed to doorman. I mean, they could have just done anything with this visual facial replacement. I mean, I'm surprised Nick Offerman wasn't put on my face in this thing. But Nick's Twitter handle is, anyways, So it was great. It was great working on the show. It was great working with Ted. Most of my scenes were with Ted. You're working with a guy that before you even became an actor, you'd watched on television. That's always a trip, right? Yeah. And so, it's always a trip when you're doing scenes or films with people who are wildly famous, and yet you've seen countless times and countless things, and now you're sitting there doing a scene with them. You know, it's obviously you got to be a professional. You got to chill out and just, play the scene. He was great. He was just loves to act and loves to work on stuff and loves to get it right.
Yeah.
So, that was a trip. And then I was with everybody.
Come through to a restroom, right?
Yes.
To a men's room or something?
Oh yeah. Then I was working with Adam was there. Mm-hmm. Darcy again, she's just, amazing,
Pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
Had you worked with Maya before?
Never worked with. She wasn't there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, when all the stuff is VFX'd in?
No, she wasn't there.
That was a different day?
She came. They shot her on a different day.
Hollywood's a lie. Everything's a lie.
Yeah, we did not work on that scene together.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I love the specificity of this show and, the severity that's given to the stupidest things. Like, the key is very important. It's made from the first atoms that came into existence in the uniform, and it can't be duplicated because it's marked "Do not duplicate."
Yeah, right? Yeah. I know.
Another example of this being like the smartest, dumbest show on
television. Yeah. Like it was great, and we were doing that. It's funny. Again, just the magic of movies. We'd be trying to go through that door, and the lock wouldn't work. And I try to put it in, and it wouldn't thing. And then it was
in real life.
And so then you're blowing this take.
Yeah.
Because the lock wouldn't work, and I was like, "What the hell's going on with you? This is what happens when you have an apostrophe in your last name. The lock doesn't work. The security guards don't let you in."
There's a frog theme.
The frog theme was just. Frog guy. Hey, you brought me a frog. I mean, it was just, again, like.
It was in the script, right?
Yeah, it was in the script. But this is what I love about the writers. And I relate to this as a writer, too, is like they just decided that the thing that this guy was going to be excited about was going to be frogs.
For no reason.
Maybe it'll pay off, this season or whatever. I haven't got the phone call yet. My quote's gone up. But anyways, you've got this guy and he's getting, it's always fun, I think, when you're my age, I'm 52 now, to have to play that kind of giddy, kid-like joy, which you don't get to play that often, because when do you ever see adults that happy other than, when their kids don't fail out of college?
Especially for something that's so silly as a frog keychain or a frog coffee mug.
A frog, it's a frog,
And it's such a sharp contrast to, you are very bored, middle of nowhere in the afterlife, fairly blue collar guy that's, I'm a rubber stamp.
I'm just sitting here.
Yeah.
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 And I gotta, just sitting here for eternity.
But that frog, Michael bringing you those things creates a bond so that you help him at one point and toss him the keys and allow him to go back to keep swinging.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Pretty
and it was fun. And then I was supposed to do the season finale, but I was on vacation with my kids, and I was like, I can't,
Where were you?
I was in Lake George.
Oh, nice.
And
New York.
I have spent many too many vacations over their years leaving. Everyone's there. I go away for 2-3 days. I was like, I just got to be. Because, somebody said, and I think they're right about this, is that kids remember their parents when they're on vacation with them. It's because that's when they have their undivided time. That's when they have their attention. That's when they have their focus. And, when you work in our business, there's also the adage, if you want to book a job, book a vacation.
Buy a plane ticket.
Right? Because, 100%. You make plans and they're going to be changed. And and there's a little bit of... when they're younger, you can take them out of school, and when, it doesn't matter, you can kind of be away with your family whenever it's convenient for you and you're not working. When your kids get a little bit older, they're on school schedules, and I have kids in three different schools. So, you know, having time with them. So that was disappointing to me because I wasn't able to do it. And I was just like, guys, I'd love to do this, but I can't.
Do you know what the storyline was?
I don't.
I wonder. Mike O'Malley, what's good?
I think what's good is people's understanding of how complex other people are.
Empathy, I feel like you're describing.
I think so, yeah, I just, you know, whenever I see something really kind of crazy happen, like, or scandalous happen with people, I'm not the first one to be like, did you see what this jackass did? Oh my God. Like, I'm, the first thing I was like, oh my gosh, the poor shame they must be feeling, the shame that their family must be feeling. Like, I think about, like, you know, the trouble that they're going through, not like, these arrogant, you know, like the right. college, you know, thing. I was
the
just
college
like,
bribery
just like,
thing.
Oh, like I see the college bribery thing, and like I understand that your reaction or how you're either owning up to your mistake or not owning up to your mistake is worthy of, you know, criticism. But when I see, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, this is just, this is people trying to love their kids, right?
It's
it's misplaced. It's
illegal.
It's illegal. No. But I mean, like, but it's unethical. But
sure.
but you can see how they could get so twisted around to doing anything for them because the world is competitive. It just is, right? And so I think that, again, this is wrapping back around to what's good is I'm just like everyone else. I want to be like, that, you know what I mean? Get that person or da-da-da. But then I think, well, how would I want people to be thinking of me if I made a mistake
if
like that?
If the story broke about me.
Well, just in, that's what I'm trying to say right here. This is a story that's going to break. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, is this where you drop? No, this is where you confess?
My kids aren't old enough to get into college yet, but you know what I mean?
Talk to us a little bit about the Innocence Project.
Well, so the Innocence Project is something that I really believe in because I believe that anyone could be in the situation of the people that the Innocence Project is trying to save and help. And that is to be falsely accused of a crime and to be put on death row or to be put in jail. And via the Innocence Project, testing the DNA evidence and getting people off death row. So I don't even want to have a conversation about whether or not, you know, people think capital punishment, like, you know, we talk about Jeffrey Dahmer. It's like, does this guy deserve, you know what, if you're going to, let's talk about people who might deserve this thing.
Sure.
The problem is that there are people who have got off death row, who people were convinced should have been on it, who shouldn't have been on it because they had the wrong evidence. And the Innocence Project then pays for their trials and the testing of the DNA evidence to get people off death row. And I think it's all of our responsibility in this country if somebody is put to death or falsely accused and could have got off, that's on all of us because we have the power to say this shouldn't happen, right? Who can you imagine what these families are going through? Like you see these stories all the time. A guy got out of prison 25 years. I mean, like how this person, put it this way. There's not a person who's done like whatever it is, 20 years in prison, 1 year in prison, like how they're not making the equivalent of what Nick Offerman made in the last season of Parks and Recreation as a penalty that this entire tax base is paying for. It's on us. This is a government of the people, for the people, by the people. Well, if we're putting people in jail that shouldn't be there, in prison, as you can call it jail, in prison, who shouldn't be there, well, we should... we should probably pay for that. And the thing about the Innocence Project is it doesn't matter, you know, red state, blue state, you know, Republican, you know, libertarian, Democrats, whatever. No one would agree that someone should be in prison who shouldn't be. You know, the fact that there even needs to be a charity that pays for this, it should just be like a department of the federal government.
Yeah, the Department of Checking.
The Department of Checking whether or not we're executing the wrong people.
Yeah. You can check it out at innocenceproject.org. Mike O'Malley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. And I look forward to The Doorman coming back in season 4.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Thank you for listening. Work hard and be nice to people. and go do something good.
Listen, man, all I've learned from The Good Place is if you go on vacation with your kids, you don't get to be on The Good Place anymore. Show where your priorities are. Yeah, maybe we'll have you back, maybe we won't. Enjoy your family in Lake George, doorman.
Thank you for listening to What's Good with Mark Evan Jackson on The Good Place, the podcast. It was a delight having you. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson. Produced by Grant Rutter. Written by Lizzie Pace. Edited by Trey Booty. Those are four of my best friends. And yours. Bye.